Chapter 37 Chatal Hoek. The half-sized clay figures looked out at me from the museum display case, staring straight ahead. Some were double-headed, perhaps a husband and wife. As I moved around the room, I felt their black outlined eyes following me. I got as close as I could to one figure and gazed into the cowrie, or sea snail, shell eyes. The black bitumen, or tar, dots of the pupil seemed to burn deep into my soul. I was hypnotized by the power of a figure buried with 30 others in a pit sometime around 8,000 BC. This was one of those rare moments when I have been confronted by the force of ancient beliefs. There have been others, Ice Age paintings in French caves and at Altamira, Spain. See Chapter 14. A few minutes alone in complete darkness in a pharaoh's tomb in Egypt's Valley of the Kings, tracing the ancient legend of the Maya creation, as painted on a clay bowl. But few have been as powerful as the time spent with those figures from Ain Ghazal in Jordan. The clay modeled around bundles of twigs, the painted clothing and hair and the tattoos. I felt myself in the presence of the ancestors. Like other early farmers, the Ain Ghazal people buried the decorated heads of their forebears under their hut floors. Kathleen Kenyon had found plastered skulls under 7,000 BC houses at Jericho. See Chapter 30. At Ain Ghazal, the people also made models of their ancestors, which stood in house shrines. Even looking at them in a museum, you feel as if previous generations of your family are staring out at you, watching over their descendants. The more we learn about early villagers in the Middle East, the more we uncover evidence that respect for those who went before was a powerful force in society. Why was there such concern with earlier generations? We know from living traditional societies that ancestors are often considered the guardians of the land. They ensure that harvests grow and life continues as before. The same was definitely true in the past. A deep respect for ancestors has been part of human belief ever since farming began, and probably for much earlier in prehistory. The Jericho skulls and the Ain Ghazal figurines show that ancestor cults were part of societies that lived from one harvest to the next. Crop failure, hunger, and malnutrition were harsh realities for earlier and later generations alike. A concern with the continuity of life was central to early farming societies, which was why ancestors were important. The beliefs about ancestors held by traditional societies today have reached us in the form of spoken stories or songs, passed down through the generations. But what about the beliefs of much earlier societies, such as the first farmers? We can only rely on archaeology and material remains of the past to tell the tale. Fortunately, a Turkish farming settlement named Chatal Hoek and a carefully planned long-term excavation have shed much more light on the power of the ancestors. James Millart, 1925 to 2012, was the British archaeologist who discovered Chatal Hoek. He had learned his excavation with Kathleen Kenyon at Jericho, and so he knew a village site when he saw one. During the late 1950s, he surveyed the Konya Plain in central Turkey in search of Bronze Age sites. Instead, he came across the two mounds of Chatal Hoek, the larger of them 20 meters high. Millart dug Chatal Hoek from 1961 to 1963, uncovering 13 occupation levels of a settlement that dated to around 6,000 or 5,500 BC. He thought up to 8,000 people could have lived there at the height of its power. The excavations investigated more than 150 rooms and buildings. It was a crowded place. Houses were packed together so tightly that they had no front doors, but were entered through the roof. The rooms included shrines with clay bulls' heads, plaster reliefs, and wall paintings. There were also small female figures. Millart believed that the people worshipped a mother goddess, a symbol of fertility. He even suggested that some of the wall paintings were based on textiles, ancient prototypes for modern Turkish carpet designs. But for various controversial reasons, Millart had to cut his work short and his dig was closed. Millart's excavations caused quite a stir. Chatal Hoke covered 13 hectares, making it about 10 times larger than most settlements of the period. Many questions remained unanswered, but the Turkish authorities did not permit new excavations until 1993, when another Englishman, Ian Hodder, born 1948, started an ambitious, long-term research project that has continued ever since. Thanks to his carefully designed teamwork, the ancestors are now emerging from the shadows. Hodder is an experienced and imaginative archaeologist, one of the few with the vision and skills required to undertake such a job. He involved in the excavations not only archaeologists, but experts in all kinds of disciplines. Everyone had to share information freely, including research notes. Right from the start, the team worked closely with the Turkish authorities, who have developed the site as a potential tourist destination. From the beginning, Hodder thought of the Çatalhöyük project as an excavation concerned with people. He believes that the past was created by people, both as individuals and as members of groups large and small. Just as we do today, the people then interacted with one another, with their society, and with their ancestors. Hodder realized that Çatalhöyük had the potential to reveal such interactions. Long-forgotten ancestral beliefs would come down to us in the form of material objects found during excavation, in shrines, temples, and elsewhere. Hodder set out three basic principles. First, we couldn't look at the past purely through ecology, the relationship between living organisms and their environment, technology, or ways in which people fed themselves. Second, we must focus on neglected aspects of ancient societies, among them ethnic minorities, women, and the anonymous people, often illiterate commoners. Third, we must always consider the wider significance of the research for the public. Many archaeologists had voiced some or even all of these three principles before, but no one had embraced all of them from the outset. Everything depended, of course, on excavation. The team addressed two basic questions early on. When did Çatalhöyük come into being, and what was the first settlement like? Trenches dug down to the base of the East Mound tell of a small settlement that flourished close to a wetland in about 7400 BC. Animal bones and seeds prove that the people had been farmers. They also relied on fish, waterfowl, and game from the surrounding landscape. This small village flourished for 1,000 years thanks to fertile soils, plenty of water, and a combination of agriculture and herding. At first, only a few hundred people lived at Çatalhöyük, but as cattle herding became more important, the population grew to between 3,500 and 8,000. This was when the village became Millard's small town of densely packed houses. It was now an important place, known for miles around. The villagers were lucky, for they lived within easy reach of volcanic lava flows, where obsidian, or volcanic glass, could be mined with little effort. Shiny, fine obsidian is ideal for making stone tools. Çatalhöyük's inhabitants seized the opportunity to shape thousands of standardized blocks of the material that could easily be carried and then fashioned into small, sharp-edged tools. The obsidian trade was huge and extended as far as Syria and beyond. Çatalhöyük prospered, so much so that those who lived there rebuilt their houses at least 18 times over a span of 1,400 years, until occupation ended in about 6,000 BC. Now Hodder and his colleagues could truly focus on people and their voices. To this end, they have excavated more than 166 houses, not just single dwellings, but sequences of houses, all built at the same location. The settlement consisted of tightly packed clusters of flat-roofed dwellings, separated from one another by narrow alleyways. The same groups of people occupied and rebuilt the houses on the same spot for generations, suggesting strong kinship ties between neighbors and those who had lived there in earlier times. The glue that held the community together was the close flesh-and-blood connections between individuals and their families, and with other relatives who lived nearby or farther afield. These connections also linked living people and their ancestors, which was one reason why kinship ties were so important at Çatalhöyük. The town's inhabitants never built large public buildings, temples, or ceremonial centers. Everything happened inside their houses, eating, sleeping, tool-making, and rituals of all kinds. Nor did they bury their dead in cemeteries. Day-to-day life and spiritual beliefs blended together. We know this because the walls of many houses have paintings of humans and animals, such as leopards and vultures. It is as if the ancestors, animal and human, were watching over the living, and many of the houses contained burials as well as the skulls of wild bulls. Sometimes the heads of the dead would be detached and their faces plastered over. The heads were then displayed and passed on from one generation to the next. All of this speaks of a complex world of myths that gave meaning to daily life. We know more about this meaning from a small number of houses that were apparently never inhabited. Instead, the dead dwelt there. The average inhabited house contains between 5 and 8 burials. But these special houses contained many more. 62 bodies were deposited in one of them over a 40-year period. Their furniture included sacred wild ox skulls and clay models of bulls' heads. The walls bore paintings of bulls, headless people, and birds of prey, clearly actors in rituals performed in the shrines. Each of the uninhabited houses had a history for those who built and maintained them. Sometimes people would even dig into the floor to recover the prized bull skulls left by earlier generations. They also made a practice of placing teeth from earlier burials into later ones. Hodder calls these few uninhabited structures history houses. They were places where people could communicate with their ancestors and their history using familiar rituals employed by those who had lived before them. History houses may also have witnessed ceremonial feasts that celebrated wild bulls. These dangerous animals had huge spiritual power in farming societies over wide areas of the ancient Middle East. The people created and maintained this history by living on and over the dead, and by recycling body parts, such as ancestral skulls. Ancestors, both human and animal, protected the dead, the house and its inhabitants. Associations between dangerous animals, headless humans, and birds of prey, shown in wall paintings, reinforced the continuity of life before and after death. Chatalhoke's farmers lived by a calendar of changing seasons. Spring and planting, birth, summer, growth, autumn, harvest, and then winter, death. This was the ultimate reality of human life, the reason why people revered and respected their ancestors. They knew that they would become them one day. This was also why female figures and possible fertility goddesses were respected. They renewed life. The Chatalhoke Project is far more than just archaeology. Hodder has used the excavations and the research of dozens of experts to create a complex history of a community deeply concerned with its ancestors. This was a place filled with complex relationships and tensions. We look back on a community with many noisy voices. There is another voice, too, that of the modern local people. Chatalhoke is part of their history, but it is also far more. Many of the local farmers have worked on the excavations. The site is becoming an archaeological museum, visited by tourists from many countries. Hodder and his colleagues have talked about their discoveries to the villagers living nearby. They have trained museum attendants and guards with the help of Turkish archaeologists. Hodder has even written the life story of one of the site guards. The archaeologists from many lands and their work have become part of the local landscape. This is what we call engaged archaeology. Archaeology that is involved with the past and with the modern world. Archaeological research and protection of what is found go hand in hand. Archaeologists commonly refer to people with an interest in a site as stakeholders. At Chatalhoke, the stakeholders include the people from the surrounding communities, also the foreign and Turkish archaeologists who work at the site, and the people who look after the museum. The tourists are stakeholders too, for Chatalhoke is part of the common cultural heritage of all humankind. And when we talk of stakeholders, let us not forget the ancestors.